Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Mitch Wagner, and we're going to be discussing A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, winner of the 1961 Hugo Award. So Mitch, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, hi, Seth. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You're welcome. You were actually the first person to reach out using the contact form on the website. And as we've previously discussed, it sounds like you kind of came over when Lisa Schmeiser guested, which validates my nefarious plan for getting guest hosts from The Incomparable over so that they could bring audiences with them.
Should we have an evil laugh here, your nefarious plan?
Exactly. I think you have to start it with mwahaha.
Yes, yes. You got to hit the M harder. Yeah, yes.
Definitely. So we're going to be talking about A Canticle for Leibowitz. You actually had thrown out quite a number of books, and you had the fortune to be one of the early people who reached out to me. So you kind of got to pick whatever you wanted. Although, as I recall, you waffled a little bit.
Yeah. I was going through my email. I actually had picked Yiddish Policeman's Union at first. Right. I really love that book. I don't know why that was the first one that came to mind though, but I loved it. Then I think even before that I picked Heinlein because that's kind of my go-to, but then I decided not to do it because Heinlein is my go-to and I always talk about him. And I also was going to do, The Forever War because I'm a fan of that novel and Joe Haldeman's a friend. But again, I've talked about that a lot. Oh, cool. So I figured try something
nice
that's a little different than my usual shtick.
Well, that makes sense. And we can follow up later on because there's plenty of Heinlein on the list.
Yeah,
I'm going to need somebody to pick those eventually. So,
yeah.
Actually, I'm going to be doing, I think the next episode I record will be a Heinlein.
So, which one?
The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. So, which I think was the one that you had selected. So let's talk a little bit about you. Why don't you tell me about some of your background? You know, how did you get into science fiction?
One of the reasons I wanted to be on this podcast is I think because maybe I'm a little older than many of your guests. I'm 56. Mm. So I think what your sweet spot is kind of the 30s and 40s. You had one guest I remember who was like 22 or something. So that makes me a bit of a time traveler from a period when the attitudes towards science fiction were very different.
Yes.
It was still kind of coming out of that niche period when it was kind of nerdy and freakish and you didn't really want to be seen in public reading a science fiction novel. It was coming out of that period. It wasn't in that period yet. I was 16 years old when Star Wars came out, so it's not a childhood formative memory. For me, I remember a ton of really, in retrospect, crude science fiction TV shows and cartoons when I was a kid. Lost in Space, which I now have come to appreciate unironically, as the young people say. It was just this crazy show. Jonathan Harris mincing around is like, why did they even let him in a spaceship? And then I discovered Star Trek when I was about 11 or 12, the original Star Trek. And then when I was 12 years old, I just started, or 13, I just started devouring all the science fiction I could find. And I read a lot of the classics of what was then called the Golden Age, you know, Heinlein and Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury. And this novel would be included in that bunch, A Canticle for Leibowitz. So I guess there's never been a... Oh, and one other key step was my cousin Barry, who's about, I'd say, 15 or 20 years older than I am, even though he's a cousin. And he was a huge science fiction fan. He introduced me to a lot of those classics and also used to give me a lot of his cast-off books. And as a result, he and I have completely different science fiction tastes now because he started me out reading the stuff he didn't like. Enough to keep in his own library.
All right. That's an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah.
I don't like this. Maybe you will. That's cool.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to look down the list and see how many of the Hugo winners you'd read?
I did. Let me ask you something. What's kind of the typical count and what's the high count for your show?
I think we had a count in the 40s.
Okay.
That was the high count.
So yeah, I don't feel like such a hotshot now. I read 42 of them.
Okay, and you know that is a respectable number, and it is exactly twice the number that I've read.
Oh, is that right? So, yeah.
Yep.
Well, you're moving along because you remember you started. You'd read like none or something. So
I think I'd read 12.
Yeah.
Just kind of incidentally by picking things up. I had done a couple sort of deliberate. Oh, I should read that one, like The Man in the High Castle.
Yeah.
And Fahrenheit 451, which is my last episode that I'm going to post soon.
Yeah, I'm reading number 43 by the way. I'm reading the fifth season by N.K. Jemisin.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one that I have that I bought, but I haven't read yet. So that'll be good. And I think, did the sequel to that one win the Hugo as well?
Yeah, I think both of the two novels won. Yeah. I don't know how many are out in the series at this point, but two novels have won.
Well, how about this book? Why A Canticle for Leibowitz?
The best answer I could give you is a very unsatisfying one. It is because I love it. It's just an excellent book. I read it when I was in that formative years of reading science fiction. Like half of my reading was rereading. I remember I would pick up a new book and then I'd pick up another one. I would alternate in a very OCD-ish manner. So I must have read this one a half a dozen or a dozen times. And then not since I was a teenager until recently. So, and it does hold up to rereading today very well, I think. It's still as great as I remember it, if not even better.
Cool.
It's just got this rich history, this rich world building that's not like any other world building I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Just the theme of religion in contrast with, or playing off against secular knowledge. And I do think one of the reasons I picked this book, as we discussed in email, is because I know that I could almost describe myself as a virtual atheist.
Okay.
Like, I don't really think about God at all, except for in a theoretical sense. Like, and I read the news and I know other people worship, but I don't, doesn't play a role to me. Plus I'm culturally Jewish. And I know you are a very religious Christian. So I thought it would be a fun discussion from our two separate perspectives.
Yeah. I like having the balance, cause I've had some guests who are also Christians or Catholics I do like to have, different voices on.
Yeah. And by the way, it's very interesting to me. Kind of the nerd Christian culture is a great invention.
Yes.
Because as a secular person, bear in mind, all I ever see about Christianity is what's in the news.
Which is not necessarily putting its best foot forward.
Which is actually putting its worst foot forward.
Yes.
But then I get to go into this other universe I inhabit and see, hey, Christians are nerds too. And, exactly. You know, there's one site I read for Mac News that's just like all different apps that they love. And they love OmniFocus like I do. And they love this like I do. And they also have their favorite Bible reading app. And they will discuss the user interface on that Bible reading app. And it's just like, to me, it's like, wow, this is great.
Yep. So how did you mentioned that I was going to ask how you first encountered the book. I think you kind of already covered that was just something that was kind of formative at the right time for you.
Yeah, it was when I was reading a lot of science fiction voraciously. So it's quite possible I even saw it when I saw that it had won the Hugo Awards.
Okay, nice.
And it was also a book that I remember possibly now and possibly then was taught in school too. So maybe that's where I encountered it. Maybe actually a teacher gave it to me. I don't recall.
Okay. Well, one of the cool things that I also like here is that since for the vast majority of these books, I'm a first-time reader, and I like when I get somebody on who's read the book several times because they bring a different perspective to it while I'm just initially processing it, and that helps me process it.
So. Yeah, yeah.
So that's cool. So why don't we go ahead and go into our kind of non-spoiler discussion of the book? We kind of already have just talking about your history with it, but do you want to give kind of a little elevator pitch for the book?
Sure, sure. So basically it takes place, I think it's 500 years after nuclear war has completely obliterated civilization. And we've got a teenager who's a novice monk in the desert going through an initiation trial. And he encounters an old man in a breech cloth who is wandering around in the desert with him, and he's trying to build himself a little shelter to keep the bugs and rats off the novices, the teenager, that is. And the old man helps him out. And in the course of that, he finds an abandoned bomb shelter with a bunch of artifacts of the glory days of the 20th century before the flame deluge destroyed civilization. Right. And these turns out to be contain artifacts of the blessed Leibowitz, whom this monk is part of an abbey that's trying to get the blessed Leibowitz canonized as a saint. We learn in this period that the Catholic Church is as it did, according to many scholars in our real Middle Ages, the Catholic Church is trying to preserve knowledge and preserve civilization through this new dark age. So the first part of this novel is all about these monks in what we learn is the southwestern American desert, trying to assimilate this new information and working to get the blessed Leibowitz canonized as a saint. which he later does. And there's adventurers with bands of mutants and cannibalistic mutants in the deserts, and all sorts of good fun. And the young monk is a great. What I don't think I realized this when I was a teenager, but the young monk, Brother Francis Gerard, is a great comic character because he's kind of a dope. But although later we learn he's kind of really good-hearted and actually pretty intelligent. I think today we would say he's on the spectrum.
Yeah, that so could
he,
be.
He seems very intelligent, but he's socially clueless. And there's all these wonderful characters floating around. There's the abbot, who's this savvy politician and knows that they have to produce miracles by St. Leibowitz, but they can't be too miraculous.
Right.
Like curing someone of an illness is good, but like having him appear in the desert and guide the monk to the artifacts in the guiding light, that's overdoing it.
Yes. Nobody's going to buy that.
And then we graduate. The only thing I'll say in the non-spoiler part after that is that they go forward through the centuries. We follow these monks in this abbey through the centuries as civilization rebuilds itself. And the other thing I'll say in the non-spoiler part is that we see the theme of the novel is basically that the abbey is a character. It is explicitly said that the abbey itself is a person, and the individual people within the abbey, the monks, are just the cells of that body. And this is not in a science fiction or fantasy way. This is just they are all working together toward the greater goal.
No. And that's consistent with biblical imagery of one body, many parts.
Yeah. And overall, the theme of the novel is secular knowledge placed in opposition to faith. And can they coexist together?
Yeah. So just in terms of kind of overall thoughts, as kind of on a first read for me, I really, really enjoyed the first part, especially. I really enjoyed Francis, like you said, as a character. I thought he was interesting, kind of bumbling, trying to figure out, well, what do I say here? Do I tell the truth? Because people are getting on me for telling the truth. And it was interesting too, how the truth got embellished. As he took, told it, and then it was handed off to other people, and there was some accretion of legend that went on there.
He's savvy enough to know that everybody wants him to lie, and it's like he really wants to lie to get along, but he just can't. And he has found the actual truth satisfies no one. The abbot wants him, if I remember correctly, because I reread it a couple of months ago. The abbot, if I recall, wants him to get the old wanderer out of the picture entirely. Just say you never saw him, or maybe say you're absolutely. Yeah.
Are you sure
and
you saw that guy?
Maybe he was a hallucination because you were starving and in the desert. And the guy's like, no, I definitely saw him. But then everybody else wants him to say he's this miraculous figure. And Gerard can't lie for them either. He can just, all he can do is tell the truth.
Yeah. And so it was fascinating to me when then we switched to the second section. And this part kind of goes into the origin of the book as three novellas that were stitched together. And that was an interesting thing to me. I'm not sure how much it worked for me toward the end. With this skipping of, 600 years between each section, anytime it's that kind of a book, your mileage may vary on the three different parts. And the first two really, really worked for me. And the third one, I'm still kind of processing, but I don't know. What do you think?
I like that kind of jumping. I remember first encountering it in the Foundation trilogy. It's almost like you as the reader have a secret knowledge, because in the second part, the characters of the characters of the preceding part are to the characters in the current part that you're reading. They're all kind of like these figures lost in misty history.
Yes.
That are semi-mythological almost, because it all happened 600 years ago to them. But to you, you just read it yesterday. So, these guys really well. So you're kind of in on this secret knowledge.
Right. Well, that's interesting. The idea of it being kind of meta for when you go back and reread it.
Then you're
the one rediscovering these old saints.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool.
And the Foundation trilogy did that.
Well, let me jump off of that and talk about, what kind of person, fans of what other genres or books or movies do you think would enjoy A Canticle for Leibowitz?
This is definitely, there's a couple of themes being hit on here. We're getting into spoiler territory. Is there a spoiler horn to blow or something?
There isn't usually after kind of talking about the
other fans. All right. So
right now we're still trying to convince people who haven't read it to go read it before listening to the rest. So,
let's see, fans of any kind of, Mad Max stuff, Road Warrior stuff. It's in some respects the opposite of the Road Warrior, in that these guys are monks. They're meek, they're nonviolent. They get when they encounter combat, they get the crap kicked out of them. But
right.
still, you've got this after civilization has fallen, and barbarians are storming the gate.
Yeah.
So any kind of novel that or movies that touch on those themes, this would be fans of them. Plus the idea of this kind of deep history spanning 1700 years, civilizations falling and growing again.
I was looking at it and going, you know, it's somewhat bleak, right? Because just by nature of it being a post-apocalypse and the idea that there was a terrible war that, you know, that they call the flood deluge, right? Mm-hmm.
The flame deluge.
It was almost like a second flood that cleansed the earth.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was looking at it, and there's a sense of cyclical history too, right? Where it reminds me of Battlestar Galactica a little bit, right? All of this has happened before and it will happen again.
Yep.
And reminded me a little bit of On the Beach the road, because they're both kind of history is winding down, right? We're moving toward the end and it's not exciting. It's inevitable.
Oh yeah. It's it also reminds me of absolutely one of my favorite novel series, wonderful, wonderful series, called, and I've built it up and blanked on the name. oh, I hate when that happens. Basically, it's about The Last Policeman.
Oh, right.
Oh, my gosh, that was so good. And basically, the idea is you start out with this mystery within two mysteries going on. It's just this guy and this police officer in this typical American small city, very suburban. He's investigating somebody found dead in the bathroom of a fast food restaurant. Like a Starbucks or McDonald's or something. Mm-hmm. And the guy's just dead in the bathroom. And the two mysteries are like, how did he get there? And B, why does nobody really seem to care?
Right.
And the reason nobody seems to care is because scientists have determined that an asteroid is going to strike the Earth and destroy the Earth in 6 months. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. Everybody's just going to be dead in 6 months. And it's just such a beautiful, sad novel. And again, it's like the inevitability of decline. And the other thing about Canticle that's really interesting, I think, is he does it is there's a lot of humor in it.
It's
a very gallows black humor, a lot of it, but it's there. Would this be a good time to talk about the background of the author?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so Walter Miller wrote this. He was very well known at the time as a writer of short fiction. This was a period when, you know, short fiction was thriving. Short fiction was like the television of its day. You can't really do commercial short stories anymore, but at that time you could even make a living at it if you wrote fast and lived cheap. And so he was well known for doing about 30 extremely well acclaimed short stories. This was the only novel published during his lifetime. And he had a very sad life. He was a bomber pilot or part of a bomber crew during World War II that participated in the bombing of an ancient Roman Catholic monastery called Monte Cassino in Italy, that basically played the same role in real life to some extent that the Order of St. Leibowitz plays in this novel.
Sure.
What's amazing about the story of this novel is that he was unaware until he'd almost finished it that he was basically writing out this thing of his own life that had traumatized him. Right. And the other thing is... I actually clipped something from an article that was about him because I thought it was both beautiful and kind of appalling. The author of his one of his obituaries wrote that science fiction writers often have the ability to predict the future. And Miller did that one day in 1999 when he called the police in his small town to say that there was a dead man on the lawn of his house and then killed himself. And it was just like, wow.
Yeah.
He was very reclusive. He wrote a letter to, I think, a writer named Terry Bisson, who later on finished a sequel to Canticle. And he wrote this letter to Bisson that was very admiring and said at the end, "Do not think from this letter that I want to meet."
Wow.
Yeah. But he was a genius because he wrote this novel and he wrote a number of excellent stories.
Yeah. Well, you can definitely see kind of how part of his mindset was in that hermit, you know, recluse, monastic kind of mindset.
Yeah. That didn't even occur to me. Yeah, and I'm almost making it like I'm thinking if I'm one of your listeners now, like, why would I want to read this depressing book? But yet it's not. It is in some ways joyous.
Interesting. Well, let's circle back to that in spoiler talk.
Okay.
Because I have seen perspectives from that from different people.
Mm-hmm.
And on that topic, why don't we go ahead and just move into spoiler talk? I think it's that time.
All right. So
freeform discussion, anything you want to talk about, and maybe we should just pick that up right there. I will say for anybody who hasn't read this, it's not an incredibly fast read, not certainly as fast as some of the books that I've read for this. But it's nothing that I ever thought was a slog. I thought it was beautifully written. I really did enjoy the characters. So I'm definitely giving it a thumbs up and saying you should read this one.
Yeah, I found some of the church liturgy stuff a slog the second time through. Oddly enough, I don't remember that bothering me when I was a teenager.
Well, there is quite a bit of Latin in there, and I just started. Is some of it? I was like, oh, can I work out the root words of that? You know, from high school grammar and stuff.
But
lots of times I just glossed over it the way I would, a poem in The Lord of the Rings or something.
Yeah. Also, the description of the rituals, and also the description at one point where there's one little great segment where they're taking these electronic blueprints.
Yes.
And illuminating, copying them and illuminating them like manuscripts.
Yes, I thought that was fascinating. And it wasn't just a blueprint, right? It was a circuit diagram.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear, Francis describing what are obviously inductors and capacitors and resistors.
Yeah.
But he has no idea what they are.
No. And I found it was fascinating at first, but then I thought on the current reread that it went on a little long. But, the idea of them copying these documents and illuminating them like medieval manuscripts was just wonderful.
Right. So, yeah, let's talk about I was reading one of my favorite baseball writers who also writes a bunch of book reviews. And his name's Keith Law, and I'll put a link in the show notes to his. And he found the book just too depressing. And I didn't see that. And it's interesting because usually I can read his reviews and go, okay, I'm probably going to agree with that. And no, not at all. I didn't find it depressing. I thought bleak is the right word in some way. Just because of that whole cyclical thing, right? There's an inevitability about the fact that we have come from a time of technology, blown everything up, rebuilt it, and we're going to blow it up again.
Yeah.
But the way it ended, I don't know. I found it somewhat uplifting at the end.
Well, that's sort of interesting. I think most people would probably read it the way you seem to have and the way I did up until the last time I read it, which is it's cyclical, but we get better each time. So, we've achieved here in contemporary world, we've achieved a level of technology and advancement we've never achieved before. And maybe we'll blow it up, but next time we'll do it even better. And eventually we can hope that we'll get to the point where we'll finally achieve this enlightenment and not blow ourselves up anymore. But then after reading it for preparation for this podcast, I started Googling on the internet and reading a lot of things, and I found an alternate reading that is kind of depressing.
Which is
basically that the monks of St. Leibowitz have succumbed to secular temptation. They have elevated science above faith. So there's this great character at the end that I think everybody remembers. It's one of the great characters of science fiction, Mrs. Grails.
Yes.
So she is a two-headed mutant woman. And she is very simple-minded, Mrs. Grails is. And then, now we're getting really into the spoiler stuff. There is this second nuclear war. 1,700 years in our future, we have re-achieved technology. We've gone beyond where we have, even in the 21st century. We have interstellar colonies, but we have a nuclear war on Earth that once again destroys civilization. And the Mrs. Grail's head is killed. And Rachel's head, her second head, which had previously been inert, comes to life.
Right.
And basically, according to one reading of this that I read on a Usenet archive from like 1999 or something, this is essentially a virgin birth.
Oh, interesting.
Either Rachel or Mrs. Grails is pregnant. So either Rachel or that baby is going to be a virgin birth. That is the second coming. The monks who leave Earth in the starship, they are the new wandering Jews. They have missed seeing Christ reborn.
Fascinating.
And in this reading, you see there's brother Joshua, right? He's the nerd brother who is drafted to become captain of the starship. He is struggling earlier whether he wants to take this assignment, whether he feels the calling. And he goes out into a garden and he hears a hiss. And then when he hears the hiss, that is when he decides he has the calling to become the captain of the starship. He has been tempted by the serpent. In this reading, by the way, the serpent. So we mentioned the character wandering in the desert. this character is shown to be an old man who is also immortal. He appears in every segment of every one of the three segments of this novel, and he is the wandering Jew.
Yes.
So in this reading of the novel, the Jew is the serpent, which as a Jewish person myself, I'm kind of uncomfortable with, but what the hell? It was 50 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that Miller was necessarily intending that, because he certainly doesn't show that Benjamin, or I mean, he has several names, that he's any kind of malign character.
I could argue that both ways.
Okay.
I think one of the things that makes this novel powerful and why it's often taught in school is that it's a novel with kind of hidden readings, and you have all this symbolism in there and little clues as to what he wants to say, and the name of the abbot. The first abbot's name starts with A, and the last abbot's name starts with Z. So that's the cycle of history.
Right. Sure.
Now, in Christian theology, Satan tempts you.
Right.
Now, if you're a base person, he will tempt you with liquor and women. But in this novel, these characters in this novel aren't going to be tempted by that. So they're just tempted by this charming, irascible old man. He's kind of a jerk at first, but when you get to know him, he's really lovable and he's very entertaining to be around. That's a form of temptation, isn't it? If you're the kind of person who likes charming, irascible people.
Who doesn't like charming, irascible people?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's two ways to read that. Like I said, it's one about the fall being inevitable, and the other way to read it, the more conventional way to read it, is that we fall, but we rise up again even higher next time.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought, I mean, in terms of kind of still talking about the Benjamin character, one of my favorite moments is toward the end of the second part. When he comes in, when Thon Taddeo, is that his name, Taddeo?
Taddeo.
When he's giving his address to the monks after he's been there for a while. And then the wanderer comes in and looks at him really intensely, and then kind of disappointed says, no, it's still not him. And that's him, I believe, looking for the Messiah.
Yeah. 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 He's tarry thou till I return, I believe is a line from the Bible. So he's waiting for the Messiah to return.
Yeah. And I kind of wanted to see it circle back to that at the end and see some fulfillment there, but, and I'm not sure that I got it, but I don't know. What do you think?
You wanted to see the Messiah return?
Yeah, or I mean, I guess I don't know where that character ended up at the end of the book.
I don't know either. I was sure when I was when I read it as a kid, I was sure that he ends up on the starship with the monks.
Oh, fascinating.
But I don't remember that from this rereading. I don't remember spotting that. He seems to just kind of disappear and never really be accounted for.
Yeah, so that's kind of one of my one lingering, not disappointments, but like something that's still hanging there that I feel like a reread will perhaps help.
Yeah. And what did you think of the kind of retro future technology of that section? I always get a kick out of that.
Oh, I thought that was great. When they're working on creating the arc lamp and the dynamo.
Yeah, well, I was thinking the third section. Yeah, that, but the third section too.
Right, with the autodidact not didact. That means teaching. The dictation machine. Right?
Yeah, they had a dictation machine that was like took up the entire desk and part of the wall of the office building.
And that to me, I kind of wondered, is this the typical thing of, you know, Asimov era of science fiction where you just assumed that computers would always be made of vacuum tubes and fill whole rooms?
Yeah.
And yet there's also spaceflight at the same time, as if spaceflight isn't, you know, inextricably linked with computers and that kind of stuff, and smaller computers the way we have now.
That kind of mid-century science fiction tended to usually overestimated the advances we'd make in transportation technology and underestimated communications. Right.
Yeah, definitely. On the other hand, you can look at this and go, well, you got to give him a pass here because he's not talking about really our future linearly, right? Because this is a rediscovery of science and things can develop in a different way.
Yeah, I give him a pass because he was writing in 1961 or 1955.
Well, that as well.
Yeah. Personally, interesting to me, my day job carried me to Las Vegas a week or two after finishing the rereading for the big Amazon.com reInvent conference for their cloud service. They were basically announcing a service for doing what that auto-scriber thing did. You could speak to it and it could translate in real time and presumably doesn't have a lot of those cool switches that they had in 1861 computers.
No, I wouldn't think so. None of the little factory knobs that you have to tweak just right. Yeah, a lot of the kind of machine learning applications right now are for speech or image recognition.
Yeah.
So, and it's been interesting to see how much better that technology has gotten, just even on our phones.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, well, the phone accesses the stuff in the cloud, so.
Mm-hmm. So one thing in that second section, which is, that's Fiat Lux, right?
Yeah, Let There Be Light.
That's where they're talking about that arc lamp, which was, of course, one of the early ways, the early electronic lights that we had before Edison and the filament, you know, the incandescent.
It would just be two prongs with like an arc of electricity between them. Not at all dangerous to have lying around.
no, definitely. Well, it even talked about how, you know, some of the monks that were tasked with keeping the gap just right ended up, you know, blind, which is terrible. You'd think they would have figured out a way to run a water wheel or something to keep the dynamo going, so you didn't always have to have monks sitting there cranking it. But one thing that I thought was interesting was Thon Tadeo was really apprehensive about talking to the monks. And this is, we can talk some about the secular versus religious knowledge, right? He was worried that he was going to offend people with his, you know, secular views. And he talked about a discovery that he had made about that there was potentially that the race of men that they had now was a creation of an earlier race of men that had rebelled. And that was a fascinating thing to me. And I think that's a reference to Rossum's Universal Robots.
Good catch.
That I read a couple years ago.
Good catch. I didn't pick that up myself. I had to read it on the internet later. But I actually thought it was Planet of the Apes. But that's, the timing of that is off by like 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, it is. But on the other hand, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, right?
Yeah.
There's only so many ways to tell about an overthrow of a previous culture. But yeah, I thought that was fascinating. And there's also something in there just talking about the way the monks preserved knowledge. Because when we look at our history, right, the knowledge they were preserving was typically scripture. And I don't know to what extent they preserved other writings. I know they preserved other writings of the church, but that was where the intellectual people were at those times, right? But it's fascinating to think of them copying things like circuit diagrams for, you know, alarm systems and treating them with the same reverence that they would preserve sacred texts as well.
Oh, and my favorite thing is their most sacred text of all is a note that is believed to be written by the hand of St. Leibowitz himself in the 20th century. And it says, pound pastrami, can kraut, 6 bagels, bring home for Emma.
Right. Sounds delicious. So
yeah, really. It's a good,
sounds like he's going to make a Reuben or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Reuben bagel, even better. He probably had the mustard already.
There we go. So I wanted to talk about the kind of going back to that first section where you get some of the history of the flame deluge and then the simplification that came after that, because people kind of said, well, look, all you smart guys with your technology, you screwed us.
Yeah.
And so now we're just anybody who shows any hint of thought or scientific endeavor, we're going to kill you.
Yeah. And they burn all the books and destroy all the machines. Yeah.
And they called that the simplification.
Yes.
Which unfortunately I see some of those tendencies now.
Well, they have been with us. This is a constant, constant theme. Going off on a related topic here, my wife and I just watched the first episode of The Handmaid's Tale, which I don't know if we're going to come back to, because I asked my friends on social media, is it all this bleak? And they said, oh no, it gets bleaker. one thing that intrigued me about this is the novel, people said that is basically, you could almost read the novel as being set in the same universe as Robert A. Heinlein's story called If This Goes On, that was written in 1940. Same type of thing. The United States being ruled by a religious theocracy. Interestingly, in both stories, I think what would be lost on many casual viewers is that these are not Christian governments. They kind of take on a lot of the trappings of Christianity, but nowhere do they mention Christ.
Right.
Which makes sense, because Heinlein, at least, was raised with a great deal of respect for Christianity. So he would have kind of understood that these are not Christians who are doing all these things. And there's been some speculation about whether I've blanked on the name of the author of The Handmaid's
Tale.
Margaret Atwood, whether she actually read the Heinlein and was influenced by it. And I don't think it is. I think she's just she and Heinlein were both kind of tapping into the same root. And I think that's what's going on here with Canticle for Leibowitz. We're not really seeing prophecy here with the rejection of intellectualism. We're just seeing this is constant anti-intellectualism, at least throughout the whole 20th century in the United States. H.L. Mencken wrote about it in the 20s.
Right. Yeah, it's unfortunately a tendency that we have to be suspicious of the new and anything that challenges us, that makes us think, well, okay, maybe I have to rethink my life in any way. Right, change my lifestyle to prevent environmental catastrophe. I'm going to just reject that.
Yeah, but also let's bear in mind the history too. You know, the 1950s were coming off of a period where, we'll have artificial foods, and if kids have trouble staying awake, we'll just give them pills.
Yes.
And if your little girl is overweight, give her pills. So. There was a reason to mistrust a lot of science and technology back then.
And certainly this book written, during the height of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Maybe not the height of it, but definitely in the center of it. You can see that there is a natural fear about nuclear war. And I mean, that's why it spawned so much literature during that time.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I brought up at the beginning the discussion of kind of my being 10 to 25 years older than most of your guests. I grew up, it was still going on in the 70s when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to bear, we had one of those duck and cover bomb shelter drills when I was very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped doing that soon after that. But, you went out in the hall and you sat with your head between your knees, and it was kind of along with the fire drill. You had the nuclear right. war drill. So there was and then for a few months last year, it looked like we got all that back again. And now it seems to have subsided once more, thank goodness.
My mother-in-law was one of the people who was the recipient of the ballistic missile inbound in Hawaii.
Oh yeah. A friend of mine was in Hawaii on a business trip.
Yeah.
He's just brushing his teeth in his hotel room, and he gets this message like, you're going to die in a couple of minutes and you're not even going to be with your family.
Right.
And then 38 minutes, it's like, never mind.
Sorry, our bad.
Since I know him pretty well, and he's one of my oldest friends, and he's like me, I imagine you're like terribly traumatized, and then you're like, I wonder if the hotel breakfast is still open.
Right.
Because what else are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. So, anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think we've covered a lot.
Okay.
Do you usually have other things that your reader listeners might like, if I remember correctly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we talked about that a bit, right?
Yeah.
About...
I was going to recommend a few books that are spoilers. I mentioned the Last Policeman series. There was a book that was roughly contemporaneous with this one called Alas, Babylon by Pat Frank.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Oh, you've read it. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I read it a couple times.
So I thought it would have been forgotten today. Basically the same set at the time of a nuclear war and soon afterwards.
Right.
And it's in Florida.
Yeah, that's one that my wife read in high school, and she introduced me to. I really, really like that one.
I was thinking about it this morning. It was actually written kind of on the cusp of certain attitudes toward race.
Yes.
Because on the one hand, I remember there's two main characters who are serving. So it's set in a small town in the American South.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, his name is I think his name is Frazee or something. He's got a very Southern name, and he's... Mm-hmm. The scion of this family of Southern aristocrats that has become a ne'er-do-well. And then he takes on leadership of this small town after the nuclear war. And he's got a couple of African-American house servants who are middle-aged and on the one hand seem like almost painful stereotypes. But on the other hand, I think it's mentioned that they have an adult son who's in medical school.
Yeah. 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 I don't remember having much kind of cringe reaction to that
last time
I read it. Because I do feel like those characters are actually pretty well respected. Because in large part, a lot of the survival is due to some of their knowledge of the area.
That's right. Because they are poor.
Yeah.
They know how to live. Like they have a well that produces this perfectly healthy water that smells like sulfur.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think they're the ones, I can't remember if it was them or it was somebody else who found out about the salt that they could get to.
Oh, yeah.
Because
that's another
important thing.
Yeah. So it's all about trying to rebuild. And you mentioned On the Beach, Neville Shute, classic. I'm going to throw out there Lucifer's Hammer by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle.
That's another meteor one asteroid or something, right?
A comet is coming to strike the Earth. And it's one of these wonderful novels. It's very long and it's like a roller coaster ride. In the sense that you have to kind of work for 150 pages before the payoff comes. So you're just kind of
not really selling that one.
So you're kind of ratcheting. I found it pretty interesting. So you're just kind of ratcheting up the climb to the roller coaster, and you're in 1970s affluent Los Angeles. And it's possibly Larry Niven. It's by Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, and it's possibly Niven's most autobiographical novel. Because Larry Niven was heir to an oil fortune.
Oh, okay.
So his grandfather was Lawrence Doheny, who was basically implicated in the Teapot Dome scandal in the 1920s.
Wow.
But he gave his kids a whole bunch of money, and the grandkids got a whole bunch of money. And there's one character who's heir in this novel, who's an amateur astronomer, who's heir to a soap fortune. And he's very nerdy and unworldly, except for when it comes to his own money, which it seems to me is perhaps a picture of Niven's picture of himself. So basically, a comet strikes the Earth, and everybody goes running. And a California senator goes to his ranch in the Sacramento Valley, and there's hordes of cannibal armies come out of the cities, because they totally would. it's a great, fun novel. Okay. And then the third one I'm going to recommend is Julian Comstock, A Story of 22nd Century America by Robert Charles Wilson. And it's basically like the end of the efflorescence of oil. So the world has run out of oil, and the United States has basically kind of backslid to a 19th century technology.
Interesting. That would definitely have some resonances with this one.
And that's a lot of fun. It's a romance, so it's a lot of fun.
The idea where you brought up Lucifer's hammer, that reminded me of in the third part of the book, they refer to the bomb as Lucifer.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, going back to the original Hebrew, it means day star. Ah. And that actually has a lot of, in terms of kind of symbolism, I mean, a nuke exploding would definitely be like a star in the daytime. So.
Yeah, yeah. So what was your take on all this? Do you have any particular take on this as a Christian?
I thought it was interesting that I like that whole idea of that the church at its best can be a maintainer of knowledge, not just sacred knowledge, but can keep the flame going during the dark ages of science and preserving that kind of knowledge for later times. And that's literally what's going on in this book. And to me, as a Christian who is in the sciences, I've never bought into the idea that science and faith are diametrically opposed. I see them as speaking in different, kind of driving in different lanes, looking at lots of times the same data, but in different ways. And I enjoyed some of the discussions between Thon Tadeo and which was the abbot at that point.
Oh,
Jacob.
I forgot what the abbot's name was. Yeah.
There's too many abbot names to remember. I'm not Catholic. And so some of the descriptions of the various rites, I don't know how accurate those are, but I think Miller was Catholic. So I think he would have gotten that.
Yeah. So I can't remember if we've talked about this before we were recording or after we started, but I'm kind of virtually, I could think of myself as kind of a virtual atheist. It's not really something I give a lot of thought to, faith in God. I am culturally Jewish. I was raised Jewish. And in our Jewish religious instruction, I don't know how it was for you when you were growing up, but we were always taught that the stories in the Bible were metaphors.
Oh, interesting. No, evangelical Christianity generally tends toward teaching literalism, which can be a real problem then when people go out into the world and encounter that idea that, well, yeah, maybe you shouldn't take the creation account as literal, 7 days. And it can be a painful experience. I know from experience, I grew up as a young earth creationist, and the process from starting there and moving into more acceptance of science and looking at, no, the earth is old. Scientists are not going to get this kind of thing wrong. It's not a vast conspiracy. Evidence is for the origins of life. I find convincing now. It was definitely different for me growing up.
All right. So now I want to hear about how you came to this transition.
For me, it was a slow one. Just kind of starting to allow myself to be challenged on those topics. And so I would read a book, for instance, by an old earth creationist. So it's one little step, right? It's still someone who is acknowledging God as the creator, but looking at the scientific evidence for the age of the earth. And then from there, it's, okay, well, let's look at intelligent design. And then let's look at, okay, there's this organization BioLogos, which is Francis Collins started it from the Human Genome Project. And they're very, very much, they call themselves evolutionary creationists. So they still are people of faith who believe in a creator God, but they look at the mechanism and say it was clearly evolution. And so it's been an interesting and uncomfortable lots of times transition for me to be more accepting of that. And it's the kind of thing where I just don't bring it up in some of the circles that I travel in. Because I serve in my local church, on the worship team. I am still a Christian, but I have a lot of views that other people might not accept. So
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I've sort of made almost the opposite transition. I tend to view God as kind of an ideal these days. Mm-hmm. Or a receptacle into which we put a number of ideals about the creation of the universe and the best possible face for humanity. Mm-hmm. And to me that stuff is very powerful. To say that it's an ideal or a metaphor is not to diminish it.
Right.
Getting back to my upbringing, it was always the sense that like the monks in the second part of Canticle for Leibowitz, there was always the sense that the creation story was a metaphor. And mm-hmm. we were taught in Hebrew school that the primitive peoples, the ancient Jews, weren't capable of understanding evolution.
Which makes a lot of sense, right?
Well, they were pretty smart back then. I would say they just kind of didn't need to know it.
Right. But there was no point in writing down the Hebrew Bible to discuss DNA or descent with modification or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great science fiction story called Two Dooms. Mm-hmm. I think it was C.M. Cornbluth. He writes about a scientist at Los Alamos during World War II, the nuclear research facility, who becomes friends with an Indian medicine man. And the Indian medicine man has cancer, stomach cancer. And the scientist asks him how he's feeling that day. And the Indian medicine man says, I feel terrible. A snake is eating my belly. And the scientist says, do you actually believe a snake is eating your belly? And the medicine man looks at him and says something like, of course, because what does a simple child of nature like me know about cancer and chemotherapy? So kind of the same principle, like it's a figure of speech. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
But by the way, getting back to that whole alternate reading of this, there is a sense you can read the novel that way, the middle section where the monks are all kind of smirking at the idea that they might actually believe the Bible literally. You can read that as possibly them turning away from what they should be believing.
Yeah, you could. But for someone who has my perspective now of embracing science and being a person of faith, I kind of go, I don't really hold those things in tension anymore.
Yeah.
I don't fully understand either. I don't fully understand theology or science, and I'm fine with that. But that can be uncomfortable. A lot of people don't like the idea of having doubt and doubt being good.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a friend of mine who is a religious Catholic, actually. You know, he talks about, I forget what the exact three words he uses, but he talks about there are three forms of knowledge, and one of them is the Bible, and the other one is, I think, the universe and science, and the other one is reason or something like that. And he says, where one of them appears to be in contradiction to the others, it probably means you don't understand what's going on. So if your heart tells you one thing and the Bible tells you another thing, he says, maybe it's because you don't understand the Bible or don't understand what your own heart believes. And I respect that.
Sure. Yeah. I think if we had somebody who is Catholic here to talk about some of the discussions that occurred in the final section, when they're talking about after one of the bombs has gone off, there's a lot of fallout and a lot of people affected by it. And there's a doctor that has come to the Abbey who wants to essentially use it for triage.
Yeah.
And the abbot is adamant that you cannot recommend people for euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
We won't allow that. And it was an interesting discussion. Though I do think that I don't think that the abbot had a leg to stand on, really. And this is me not being a Catholic. And I mean, there is a sanctity to life and I think it should be preserved, but not at all costs.
Yeah. So. That's the section of the novel. This idea that these guys are going to die in horrible suffering within days and this is inevitable. So therefore they should be permitted to spare themselves that. again, my Catholic friend, not my only Catholic friend, but the one who really is fiercely intellectual and outspoken about it, we've gotten in arguments about euthanasia when that has come up, you know, assisted dying. And he basically said this is inevitably going to lead to abuse. And his way of phrasing it, because he, like Walter Miller, has a really wonderful gallows sense of humor. He says it's going to start out trying to spare grandma's suffering, but it's going to end up, well, grandma's going to die soon anyway, and we need the spare bedroom. and this is why we don't want to go down that path.
It reminds me of there's an episode of Seinfeld where Kramer is filling out a DNR and trying to figure out in what situations would I want to be, want to go on living. You're like, well, I guess I could still watch TV. So we'll stick
in that case.
You know, as you full body paralysis, that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. To some extent, Miller has set up, as a philosophical argument, it's one of these pure arguments that you don't actually encounter in real life.
Right.
I mean, when do you get into a situation? I guess actually you do encounter it all the time in real life. I'm being an idiot.
you do, but not in that black and white.
No, but
I guess you would encounter it on more of an individual basis, right?
Yeah.
Where in the book they're talking about this on a mass, with mass casualties.
Yeah. So you saw that as kind of you took the side of the doctors on that one.
I think I kind of tentatively, would side with the doctors there and go, well, and this is another thing about being, I live in the Portland area. One of the very few religious people in this area. It's not an overly churched place. And lots of times churches look at it's their duty to tell the world everything they're doing wrong. And I look at it and go, but we should be just making sure we're doing right. And as an outworking of that, then, for instance, our church does a lot of service in the community, and that's the kind of thing that we should be doing, not standing on corners telling people they're going to burn in hell. And so I kind of look at the abbot there kind of stepping out beyond his purview almost. I mean, I guess he is an authority figure, right? And he actually comes down on that, right? I command you. I'm not telling you that you shouldn't do this. I'm telling you, you mustn't.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I kind of respect his stand there. He's taking his role seriously. But then it's fascinating that there's kind of that reversal that happens where he gets crushed under the falling walls at the end, and is sitting there in great pain. Though it never really talks about him wanting to, be put down or anything. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, it's thought provoking. And so I'm not sure exactly where I fall down. And this is the problem, right? It's not acceptable to have nuanced positions anymore, right? You have to be either on the extreme left or the extreme right. And if you're in the middle, well, you're just wishy-washy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I am. So.
Yeah. There was an interview I heard recently with Jaron Lanier, the kind of virtual reality evangelist. And I think technology philosopher is what some people call him. And he was saying that there's a fallacy going around that if you just kind of purge all the wrongness from society, then everything will be perfect. Right. He pointed at Steve Bannon as an example of this. And I'm no both-sider. You're familiar with the both-sider fallacy? Like both liberals and conservatives do this. And I'm not in that school. But right. In this case, I think it's true. You know, the Trump supporters think we need to get rid of all the damn liberals and the liberals think we just need to get rid of all the damn Trump supporters and then everything will be perfect.
Yeah.
And it's not going to happen.
Yeah. And that definitely has some resonance in the book too, because the abbot and the people in the monastery feel like if those darn secularists would just come into the fold, then we could stop all this war stuff.
Yeah. It's there is also this whole belief in the novel and some of the other stories we've discussed here that if there is a if there is a fall of civilization, it will come in a cataclysm, in a moment.
Right. In a flood, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or in a nuclear war, or you'll get hit by a comet, or you'll get hit by an asteroid, or there'll be an alien invasion, or the artificial intelligences will rise up overnight.
Yeah.
Science fiction is not a worldview that permits a lot of gradualism, or at least this particular genre doesn't.
Right. Although you can see the cyclical nature here as something like that. Although, like you mentioned, it does show a slow progress, right?
Yeah.
Where we've gotten a little better each time, although the technology for wiping us out is also better. So who knows, but that the unpublished fourth part of this book would be them blowing up the Centaurus system.
Well, there was also, the Saint Leibowitz and the Wild Horse Woman. Are you familiar with that one?
I'm familiar with the fact that it exists, but I have that on my list as something to ask you if you've read it.
I have read it. I remember it being pretty good. I don't remember much else about it. I would compare it to something somebody once said about The Godfather Part 3.
Okay.
That it would look like a much better movie if it hadn't come after The Godfather Part 1 and The Godfather Part 2.
Sure.
You know, Godfather Part 3 was a perfectly good and respectable crime movie.
Right.
And the same thing.
It had its moments.
Yeah. And I remember with my same feeling about reading St. Leibowitz and The Wild Horse Woman, a perfectly good and respectable post-apocalyptic stories, which is unfortunately had the misfortune to be a sequel to one of the great novels of the 20th century in any genre.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm about tapped on topics to talk about.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've gone about an hour. That
sounds good.
Pretty good.
Yeah. Yep.
So any final thoughts? Any you know, parting message to potential readers? I happen to know there are people who, even if they haven't read the book, like to listen to the whole podcast and then decide if they're going to read it. So
if you read it, that's my final thought. Read A Canticle for Leibowitz and the other books we recommended here.
Alrighty. Well, so then before we sign off, where can people find you? Do you want to plug anything?
All right. Well, let's see. I'm my day job. If you're into enterprise IT, you will be keenly interested in following Enterprise Cloud News at enterprisecloudnews.com. I am editor of that site. And if you're not into enterprise IT, candidly, you don't want to read that because it's very technical or very business oriented. You could also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and Tumblr. I'm Mitch Wagner in all of those places, and I post far too much about a lot of mid-century illustrations. I seem to be really interested in ads and pictures from magazines and also politics and nice. Jokes in poor taste and also technology news. So
cool. Well, I'll make sure to get links from you. I'll confirm them with you and put everything in the show notes.
All right.
Well, so Mitch, I really want to thank you for doing this. It was great to have you reach out to me. It's always nice to know that somebody out on the internet has found you. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for putting on this podcast. I'm looking forward to the next episode that is not me.
Sounds good. All right. Well, maybe down the line we can circle back and do a Heinlein title because there's plenty of them to choose from.
Yeah. Or one of the Haldimans.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds good. All right. Well, it was great talking to you. Talk to you later, hopefully. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Mitch. I had a great time. And I hope you'll check out any of the links that I put in the show notes to him. And I do want to remind you, of course, you can help the show in a couple of ways. If you just share this with a friend, that would be great. You know, retweet, share it on Facebook. That'd be awesome. If you have geeky friends, I think if you're listening to this podcast, you must have nerdy friends. You cannot be the only nerd in your area. So tell somebody about it. If you would give us a like on Facebook, a follow on Twitter, at Hugo's Podcast, that would be great. And of course, if you would like to leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play, I guess it's Apple Podcasts now, not iTunes, but anywhere you'd like to leave us a review, that would be fantastic. All right. I think that'll do it for this time. Thank you so much for listening.